Jeff Sand.
Juliana Henderson.
Hey.
Hey.
Hello, this is Rob Raccone speaking.
This is Juliana Henderson speaking.
Great. Well, let's see. We'll go ahead and get started here, and perhaps other people are on the phone or will join us, but for the people who are listening to this later on, we'll try and be concise and not to have too many digressions.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I would begin with a kind of 10,000-foot picture about where we are in terms of the creation of money. Seems like a relatively simple subject, but the issues that we all face as investors and as citizens all are predicated on this era of easy money and the large amount of credit that's taken place, or especially over the last 4 years since the financial meltdown in 2008. So I thought I would give an overview of how we came to be in this situation where the central banks of the world are really responsible for keeping both the stock and the bond markets afloat, and how that's affected everything else from real estate to gold, and likely going to be sort of the biggest challenge that we face as a global economy in the upcoming several years. So the creation of money, of course, goes back to when Europe was coming out of the Middle Ages, where people bartered for things, and the prosperous merchants, I think originally in Italy, first started to issue pieces of paper as kind of IOUs against goods that were in their possession or that they had control of. And over time, this gave way in various countries to the use of gold and silver and other precious metals as a basis, as a reservoir of wealth against which any piece of paper could be tendered and exchanged. And this really was the case all the way up through the end of the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century. In fact, the U.S. dollar was not a currency that was used throughout the United States until 1913. Local banks in the West, in particular, had gold dust or gold bullion or silver bullion in their vaults, and they were issuing their own currencies. And based on the confidence that local people had in these Western banks or natural resource deposits, people would have greater or lesser degrees of confidence. And so really, we're not quite at the 100th anniversary of having even a U.S. dollar. And the major players on the world scene now, of course, didn't exist back before World War I. But nonetheless, all of these banks and extensions of credit based on paper, based on resources, on actual things of value, started taking their present form in the early part of the 20th century. Now, up through the early 1930s, gold was always used as the standard on which money, on which paper money was based. And gold had a fixed price, and so there was only so much paper money that was created, and then Federal Reserve was created, and in 1935, the private ownership of gold was outlawed so that the federal government could issue paper money that was only partially based on gold, and that continued on through World War II until the early 1970s when President Nixon completely abandoned what's called the gold standard, or the right of people to exchange dollars or paper for gold. And ever since 1971, we've been living in a world where the United States, as the primary world power coming out of World War II, the only economy, really, industrialized economy that emerged from World War II unscathed and powerful, that we began to print money just based on people's confidence in our country without any reservoir of value. I'll bring this all up to the present rather quickly so that I don't drone on forever about with history lessons. But the creation of credit by banks up through, let's say, the early Reagan era in the 1980s, so the next 10 years, was relatively mild. And up through the 90s, banks created paper credit. They were pretty much controlled by the Federal Reserve, who could say, okay, you can create, let's say, $5 of loans or credit or IOUs for every dollar of capital, of supposedly real money, even though that money wasn't backed by gold. And so the Federal Reserve exerted pretty much unilateral power in the world up through the 1990s on how much credit was available. And then what happened, which is really the basis of where we are today, is that due to deregulation by Reagan and the emergence of computers and the sort of the great minds, or at least the people that think they have great minds in the investment banks, took the credit that the banks traditionally had been regulated, the amount of money that they could create under control of the central bank, and they started creating their own money. And these are the things that people hear about now in terms of collateralized mortgage or lots of different acronyms, which no one really understands, and what created the financial crisis in 2008. It was a direct result of the investment banks taking the traditional Federal Reserve, commercial bank, regulated environment, and leveraging and multiplying the kinds of credit that were not controlled by the government, so that you had Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs that had, let's say, $50 of credit for every $1 of assets that they had in their sort of figurative bank vaults. Now, when all of that came to light in the meltdown, when Lehman Brothers went under and money markets were questioned whether they were going to survive. And all of this becomes relevant when we talk about Europe now, about the problems with Greece and Spain and Portugal and Iceland, Ireland, and eventually France and other major countries are facing. When the investment banks created these complex instruments, the government and central banks essentially lost control over how much actual credit was out there, the size of the bets that people were making. And when the investments bank got into trouble, like the Spanish regional banks are in trouble today, if you read the news, the governments stepped in and created more of their own credit. Now, remember, none of this is based on any real asset. anymore because of being off of the gold standard, going back to the 1930s and then Nixon in the early 1970s. So because the great concern was that the world economy would implode if the investment banks, and therefore which were now part commercial banks and part investment banks all wrapped into one, that if they went under, that essentially world trade would stop and there'd be a Great Depression. That was the fear in 2008. So obviously the governments came in and issued their own bonds, and they ramped up their own borrowings and to lesser extents for social programs in Europe and some here. And in China, to stimulate employment, the government issued their own bonds. And so today, bringing this all home, we have a situation where in the United States, there's about $1 of real money for every $13 of government loans. And that actually is a higher risk level than is acceptable for the banking industry by the government's own admission. So, in essence, the U.S. government is in a higher risk position than what they're willing to accept for banks that operate in the United States. So the number to remember is sort of 1 to 13, and that's just government debt. And when you add in the debt that investment and commercial banks have created, it comes out to about one real dollar for every $50 of IOUs or credit. And the interest on all of this, and this is where it becomes relevant for people who are trying to earn money today, the interest on that $50 of credit, when there's only $1 to back it up, has got to be very low, because you can't possibly earn enough on a real asset worth $1 to pay off $50 of debt. That's kind of sort of self-evident. And so we're in a situation now where the government has absorbed the private debt of the banks, and no one is able to pay off their debt. And so we're looking at a very upbeat scenario. I know this is for people listening, but I think it's important that we look at, let's say, the Greek debt issue or the Spanish debt issue, and see that their overwhelming debt is never going to be able to be resolved by raising taxes or cutting social programs. The politicians say that they're going to stimulate growth. That's what the new French president has said. I call him Hollandaise, but I know his name is pronounced differently than that. Hollande, I was told yesterday. But all of that is just smoke and mirrors given the size of the debt. And whether Greece leaves the euro or goes bankrupt, what happens in Spain, and I'll talk a little bit about that later, we have a situation where most, if not all, of the major industrialized nations have created so much debt that it can never be paid off. So what does that mean for investors? Well, there are four possible or five possible scenarios of how to deal with debt that's of that magnitude relative to the size of the real economy. And the statistics about gross national product or the interest rate that people are paying in the bond markets, all of those are just sort of tips of the iceberg about this underlying sort of glacial debt. And so what are the ways that people can deal with it? They can default. Greece can default on its debt, refuse to pay back the German banks who lent them money, and they can just start over. They can reset at zero, and go back to essentially a barter economy for a while, back to the 16th century, and work their way back up to, you know, participating and having people trust them to issue credit again someday. Another way of doing it is to devalue a currency. If Greece had its own currency, or Spain had its own currency, like we do, they could essentially say, "We're going to have people be able to buy more of our goods because we're going to devalue our currency relative to the rest of Europe, so that our goods become cheaper." And other people will buy them, and thereby will stimulate growth and jobs, et cetera, in our own economy. Well, that doesn't work for Greece or any country that's in the euro, because they're all fixed to the same currency. And if all the countries of the world, all the big countries of the world, have the same problem, i.e. too much debt, it's just impossible to have everyone devalue, because someone has to be appreciating if someone else's currency is depreciating. So the kind of currency war that happened, and that's what happened at the start of the Great Depression, was there were barriers put up to trade. People tried to devalue the currency to stimulate their domestic economy. But in today's information age, you can't do that and get away with it, because everyone else will start to do it too. The Swiss are trying to do it. The Brazilians, the Canadians, Australians—they're all experiencing very strong currencies, and so it's a little bit esoteric. But that way out doesn't work. Another way that's stated to work about debt is to raise taxes and cut services, which is what Germany would like the southern countries of Europe to do. And it's what the Tea Party is talking about here in the U.S. And you'll hear a lot about that as the elections come and go at the end of this year. The real issue facing the U.S. is post-election, when the Bush era tax cuts are automatically set to expire, and lots of taxes on financial instruments and alternative minimum tax and lots of higher taxes are set to be reinstated at the end of 2012 if Congress doesn't get its act together. So you'll hear a lot about cutting programs, balancing the budget, cutting the deficit, improving trade balances with other countries. And in essence, what I believe is that none of that will make any difference in terms of addressing the size of the U.S. debt. None of those actions will come anywhere close to the magnitude of dealing with the debt issues. So, what will cope with the debt issues? We've talked about defaulting, about devaluing, about raising taxes, cutting services, and then there is inflation. When a country creates more debt, more money, there's supposed to be more money chasing the same amount of goods, and so there's supposed to be inflation. Now, the official statistics say there is no inflation, or it's very moderate. Certainly, if you're trying to get a raise at your job, or you're trying to sell your house, it's hard to see any inflation. But there's no doubt that if you go to the movies, or go out to eat, or go to buy something, a car, that cars that most goods are doubling in price about every 15 years. And so you have, let's say, a 4% inflation rate. It means that if you have $50 of debt and you have, let's say, 6% inflation in about 24 years, you'll have about $12 of debt in real terms. Your debt will be cut in half every 12 years at a 6% inflation rate. So That's why the Germans, who experienced runaway inflation in the 20s, it's why the Germans are so staunchly against printing money or extending more credit to places like Greece or Italy or Spain. And it's what the rest of the world is just blithely going around doing, is creating more credit, because the feeling is that you can inflate your way out of debt, and who ends up paying for that are the people who own assets, the people who own bonds or who are living on a fixed income. These are the people who suffer when inflation comes, especially when the interest rate or the earnings rate or the rate of return on investments is low, because there's not really growth going on, there's just inflation going on. And that is one sort of cowardly, politically acceptable way of working oneself out of debt, is inflation. And that's why the price of gold has gone up so much over the last couple of years. It hasn't gone up that much recently, and there are probably several reasons for that, which I won't go into, but the rampant inflation is the most likely way that nations have of working themselves out. And so when you have a low interest rate, high inflation environment, the rate of return on all financial assets goes down, and the rate of return on commodities or real assets, if they're in the right sectors of the economy, tends to go up. And that's part of the challenge that we face as investors, is how to produce income or cash flow for our investors in a world where the size of government debt is so large that there's no other way out other than inflation. So I think that's the big picture of where we sit relative to money, and it puts the crisis in Greece and the upcoming crisis in Spain. And what's likely to happen in Spain is that the Germans are very likely going to give in to the rest of Europe and authorize the issuance of a new kind of bond, a new kind of debt that has some fancy name to it, or that doesn't look like it's printing money, but that's essentially what it is. And if you look at the performance of the stock market since 2008, the big years, the big rally at the beginning of this year, they are all associated with the creation of more money. It has nothing to do with growth, real growth. It is all credit-driven, expansionary monetary policy, fiscal policy, whatever. Those are fancy words for the creation of money out of thin air. And when those measures have ended, the measures are sometimes called quantitative easing 1, quantitative easing 2. Now they call it Operation Twist, which is sort of a twisted way of terming it. But all of the stock market rallies worldwide are associated with money creation. And that is not the basis of a bull market in stocks. There's been some short-term bull markets, and it's one of the areas that, investing in stocks for income is one of the areas that we've been pursuing. But that creation of money has got to end at some point. I can't say when, but those are some of the things to be aware of. So I've been talking for a little while now. I think maybe I'll open it up to questions and see if I've lost everyone on the phone with my rambling.
This is Duane Trythall. So how does that relate, those things relate to the purchases you've made in the portfolios?
Sure. One of the main strategies that we've developed is to be buying high dividend paying stocks. And our feeling is that whatever kind of monkey business the governments have been up to and will continue to be up to, that private companies are smarter than the government, and that they will remain a few steps ahead of the government. And so we've been buying energy stocks and very large, stable, what we consider to be essential goods and services kinds of companies. And that pretty much describes our investment strategy. Now, we have bought some internationally stable and growing automobile companies like Toyota and Volkswagen, and those are not necessarily high dividend paying stocks, but I think that Volkswagen is probably going to be the Toyota of the future. And so that's, you know, what we have not been buying are bonds, because bonds are the mainstay of the debt economy. And the recent bonds, Jeff here showed me that a AA IBM bond for 3 years is paying under 1%, and a 7-year IBM bond is paying under 2%. So our strategy has been to change from bond buying to high dividend stock purchases for that portion of the portfolio. And when we can buy dividend stocks that are also expected to grow, and we feel like in the energy area in particular that would be the case, not so much now because they've already been bit up in price. But so, you know, we've been sort of caught up in what the Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke says, is that, you know, they understand that people have been driven to higher risk assets in order to look for some kind of, you know, decent return. And people that are sort of stuck in bank accounts or in just, you know, are restricted to government bonds or AAA corporate bonds, they're looking at, you know, their returns haven't been bad because interest rates have been ratcheted down for these political reasons, but those days are pretty much over. And so to sit with a 2% bond portfolio is to us not the way to go. So, you know, we're looking at an average earning now on stock portfolios, just cash flow, of pretty close to 4%. So that's been our strategy, Duane.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Hopefully. Let me talk a little bit more about Europe, because we have bought a substantial number of European companies, high dividend paying European companies, particularly in the telecommunications and the pharmaceutical industry, companies like Telstra, the Australian telecom, and companies like Sanofi, the Swiss drug company. These are companies whose fortunes may well in the short term be affected by the crises in Europe, the sort of brinkmanship in Europe. And I do think that Greece will leave the euro. I don't think that they or many people are willing to put up with being told what to do by a foreign power, unless they're sort of armed people in the streets telling them to do that. So I think the euro is going to come under some severe pressure, and that the International Monetary Fund will need to come in and join with the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve Bank, which is who essentially financed this recent round of easy money back in December. And that will put a number of companies under price pressure, which to us is really a buying opportunity, because we feel like their dividends are solid, and that the companies who are very well diversified outside of their country of origin, have good long-term prospects. It's interesting to note how the energy industry really hasn't done much over the last year, partially because of the doubts about world growth in a scenario where the financing requirements of governments is so unclear going forward. You have the banking requirements, and then the sovereign government requirements, and then all of that being backstopped by these sort of supranational financial institutions. And I suppose to me the question that comes up is how long can that go on, and the answer is as long as people sort of buy into the fact that there's really no alternative other than to keep the ball going in the air. The great hope is that growth, and I'm not sure how growth is created. It's partially a psychological phenomenon. It's partially where you kind of get rid of the old and start building anew is kind of the classical economic cycle, where you go through a cutback, people go bankrupt, countries go bankrupt, and then they start building again. And I think that's what will happen in Greece, is that they'll survive and come through it, but in a very changed form. Any questions?
One more quickie, if there aren't any others.
Sure.
I noticed you had sold Banco Santander. Was that out of fear of default, or just because it turned into a less attractive?
No. It had something to do with the tax consequences of it, especially in IRAs. We didn't sell it in personal accounts, but we became aware of another company that is in Canada, which we switched out of Banco Santander because there's a withholding of tax monies that does not accrue back to tax-deferred accounts.
Oh, okay.
And that just happens to be the case because of the certain kind of tax treaty between the U.S. and Spain. I like Banco Santander a lot. I think it's well capitalized. That certainly the Spanish real estate market makes California and Las Vegas look mild, because during the heyday of the 2000, during the real estate boom, 7 out of 10 people in Spain were employed in a real estate related business.
Jeez.
And that's essentially gone away. And the banks, and Banco Santander is the largest and the strongest bank in Spain. They'll actually pick up market share as time goes on. And 80% of their business is outside of Spain, most notably in Latin America, which is still a growing market.
Yeah.
But the real estate portfolio is certainly going to be marked down more. They have reserves set aside, but the reason for the change was primarily tax related.
Okay.
Well, good. One of the areas that I'll just talk about kind of in conclusion are some alternative assets and the other kinds of investment opportunities that the current environment have created. I'm not sure for how long, and how we are trying to participate in those investment areas. So and again, it goes back to the banking industry and the extreme duress that banks, almost all banks, have gone through in the U.S. And as a result of that duress and the increased government scrutiny of banking operations, there are many banks that are not lending money, especially on real estate assets. And as a result of that, there are some very good, especially at these prices, as the real estate market, which looks to be bottoming out in many parts of the country, not all of them, but in many places. So you have the real estate entrepreneurs interested and able to convince banks that are still trying to clean up their acts to buy out the bank and take back their loan at, let's say, 50 cents on the dollar. And now they let's say you have someone in Albuquerque or in Asheville, North Carolina, who wants to, you know, finish up a project, a real estate project, whether it's commercial or residential, and they can buy their loan back at 50 cents on the dollar, but they can't get the bank to finance. And so they're coming to people like us and saying, we'd like to buy our loan back. Will you lend us the money? And so we're actually in the lending business. We do our due diligence. We are what's called hard money lenders. We want not only their money but their lives at stake. So, whereas in the heyday of real estate, business people would not have to personally guarantee the loans that they took out, we absolutely insist on them having assets that they pledge outside of these projects. And so, we'll see how that goes. But this is a kind of a vacuum that's been created in the economy in terms of local lending. And it's one that is restricted to only certain kinds of investors. And it's important, to be done in a diversified and well collateralized way. But that's that. Out of the morass come some investment opportunities, and there's some very good ones out there. So I thought I'd mention that as a kind of counterpart to the sort of gloomy overview that I gave before about the extension of credit and sort of the very formidable barriers that's created to sort of a typical kind of recovery environment. We've been on for about 40 minutes. I'm wondering maybe that wraps it up for the day. If there are any final topics or areas that anyone would like to hear about, I'm happy to spend a few more minutes.
I think that's it.
If not, we'll sign off, and thank you all for joining us.
Thanks.
Okay, well, take care, everyone.